The U.S. Supreme Court's 1954 decision in Brown v. Board of Education struck down the constitutional basis for racial segregation and kicked off years of struggle to integrate America's public schools. The case is commonly understood as the capstone of a careful legal strategy planned and directed by the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People's Legal Defense Fund. But as historian Rachel Devlin discovered, Thurgood Marshall and other civil rights lawyers only mobilized after students and families began independently filing desegregation lawsuits in the 1940s. Strikingly, nearly all of these early lawsuits were filed by girls and young women. Rachel Devlin tells the story in her new book, A Girl Stands at the Door, The Generation of Young Women Who Desegregated America's Schools. Devlin is an associate professor of history at Rutgers University, and it's a great pleasure to welcome her to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, great to be here.
Very nice to have you on the program. What brought you to this particular subject?
You know, I noticed, this is a decade ago, but I noticed that in popular culture and in magazines, whenever school desegregation was being discussed in the late 40s all the way through the 60s, it was girls who were the subject of journalistic interest. And I thought, gosh, you know, is this reflecting a reality that we don't know about? Or is this editorial bias? So what I did is I went to the Library of Congress to look at the papers of the NAACP, and I found dozens of cases filed prior to Brown v. Board in the late 1940s, and all of the school desegregation cases were in fact filed on behalf of girls.
So talk about the significance of that happening and what was happening prior to Brown versus Board of Education.
So what was happening is that there were two rather important and famous school desegregation pioneers on the graduate level. So that was Lucille Bluford, who applied to the University of Missouri 11 times between 1939 and 1942. They finally had her branded a nuisance, barred her from the campus, and closed down their quite renowned school of journalism in order to not admit her. This made huge headlines in the late 1930s. In 1946, Ada Sipewell applied to the University of Oklahoma, and she was so relentless and committed that she ultimately became quite famous. While Ada Sipewell was in the headlines, parents and daughters began to act. So in locales as disparate of, you know, as rural Texas and Washington, D.C., about a dozen lawsuits were filed. So girls and their parents would simply approach white schools, attempt to enroll, and when they were rejected, they would file lawsuits with local lawyers. And what happened was that so many of these cases were coming to the New York office of the NAACP, and these girls were so determined and patient and willing to take on such risk and backlash in their own communities that Thurgood Marshall realized that they needed to take these cases to the Supreme Court many years before they had thought they would have. These cases were thrust upon them.
When it comes to the rejections, what was the reason for the rejection?
Well, so it's interesting. It was almost like in every place where girls tried this, and in some places, high school girls would simply walk in by themselves unaccompanied, but principals got word that they were coming, and they would walk out of the buildings and meet them on the steps. They would not even let them broach the front door of the school. And they did not speak to the parents. They spoke to the girl herself, and they said, "You don't want to come here," or "Why are you doing this?" And girls had to answer, you know, "I do want to come to this school," or they would say, "I want to get a good education." And the principal would be forced to say, "Well, you can't come here." And so they would just simply turn around and then go file their lawsuit. It was almost like a form of theater. This was such a radical act. in the late 1940s, that the white students would press up against the windows to see what would happen. And often the girls' black school, the entirety of the school, students, teachers, PTA, janitors, the principals, they would line up on the sidewalk across the street because no one had ever seen a black child go into a white school. So the actions of the principal were almost preordained. But you had to try to apply first before you could file a lawsuit.
Without sounding too cynical in the asking of this question, is the geography of this what you would expect?
You mean in terms of the South?
Yes.
No, I was surprised. So there were cases in Kansas, Washington, D.C., Northern Virginia, places where you might expect that people felt they could push against segregation. One of those important cases was indeed filed in rural Texas, a place called Hearne, midway between Dallas and Houston. And in that case, the girls had to be sent away to live with relatives, and their father had to stay up nights with a shotgun because the KKK had decided that they were going to kill him and his daughters. So the fact that in a place like rural Texas, and this also happened in Louisiana, that girls and their families would attempt this says something about their total determination to work against segregated schooling, to do whatever it took.
One of the things you point out in the book is just how the girls reacted to all this, how good they were in confrontations with those who were against them, whether it be a white school administrator, a reporter, a lawyer. They were very nimble in those confrontations. They had a finesse. They were good at it.
Yes. So that is why they disproportionately volunteered and were chosen by parents. Saw their daughters as especially suited to managing these encounters. In order to deal with encountering these hostile white administrators and also reporters, you have to be poised, calm, self-possessed, diplomatic, patient. And these were qualities that parents constantly instilled in their daughters as a way to deal with the harassment, sexual and otherwise, that they encountered as a daily part of their lives as a black young woman. So these skills were already firmly in place before they were sent out to speak with these white adults.
You make the point that girls outnumbered boys as the segregation cases after the firsts after Brown. And the idea that girls would perhaps have less violence attached to them in these cases. But what was happening is many people, especially in the South, were using statistics about these young black girls in regards to teen pregnancy and the stereotypes about their precocious sexuality. Those were all things that were weapons used against them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yes, and some people assume that, they look at the disproportionate number of girls and they think, oh, well, boys were more threatening, white parents didn't want their daughters to go to school with black boys. This was true, but neither did they want their sons to go to school with black girls. Girls carried with them as much sexual stigma as young men. And yes, courts use statistics about teen pregnancy and venereal disease, and they painted girls, lawyers and jurists included, black girls, as sexually dangerous. So that was, so desegregating, parents weren't any happier to receive a black girl in their school than they were to receive a black boy in their school. That really was not the defining issue.
There's something you bring up in the book that is many of the girls who were firsts when it comes to desegregation went on to be firsts in other endeavors as well. Talk a little bit about some of those examples.
You know, many of them desegregated school faculties. They became school teachers. Others became lawyers. They became bank managers, they were part of government agencies, and it turns out that they used the skills that they had learned desegregating schools in desegregating professional spaces. They knew how to be the only one in the room. They knew how to cope with that kind of loneliness. They knew how to compartmentalize. They knew how to not respond to microaggressions, which does not mean that it was easy, and it does not mean that they had a good time of it. It just means that they had developed some skills in dealing with white environments, and then they use them to be at the on the front lines of desegregating the adult world. And you know, those forms of desegregation may have been even more important than desegregating the schools, because they were setting examples for young people following them.
I guess this is a general question, and perhaps I know the answer. I guess I do know the answer to it, but I'm going to ask it anyway, which is, I just was in Kansas, and I visited the National Historic Site of Brown versus Board of Education in Topeka, Kansas.
Great.
They don't really mention that story about girls isn't really mentioned there.
Right.
And it seems to be missing often in the story, which, again, I guess this shouldn't be a big shock or surprise, but it is fascinating in the case that you make of how relevant, important, and just that it really was the story.
Yeah, I was just in Topeka myself, and the woman who runs the historic site now was shocked to find out not only about the importance of girls in bringing these cases, but the importance of women as those who helped organize these cases. Topeka might be, because of the national attention that Topeka as a lead case has gotten all of these years, has meant that the men in that town, McKinley Burnett, who was president of the NAACP, Alicia Scott, who was the lawyer, all of the attention has been on them, and Oliver Brown, who was the parent. And this was because of the emphasis put on these actors by the NAACP at the time, and because of, you know, journalists in the 1970s and 80s just assuming that it was the men in these communities that were responsible for the historic case. It was just a kind of your classic kind of who are, you know, this classical sexist assumption of who historical actors are. So in some ways, the people in Topeka have been most surprised by the argument in the book.
And yet I was also struck by there's a beautiful a mural in the second floor in Topeka, on the second floor of the state capitol. Mm-hmm. Which has an African American teacher with both African American boys and girls around her, as a symbol, obviously, of what had happened in Topeka. So it was part of that story. It is a fascinating book, and it really does. I learned a lot from it. I thank you very much for sharing with us. The name of the book is A Girl Stands at the Door, The Generation of Young Women Who Desegregated America's Schools. It is by Rachel Devlin. It is published by Basic Books. Rachel, thank you very much for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Great to talk to you.
Thank you. Be well. Again, the name of the book is A Girl Stands at the Door, A Generation of Young Women Who Desegregated America's Schools. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.